A long, hot summer today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Countries across the world have been facing near record temperatures. It's been so hot in Germany, people are desperate to find a cool spot, even a bunker.
We're walking down a cavernous concrete staircase and looking into the shaft of it, which was destroyed after the war, but it is so refreshing and cold.
Yeah, but there are better ways to cool off, like in Cuba.
There are now private temples of ice cream pleasure, former mansions that have been converted into Italian-style ice cream parlors.
Plus, this guy has traveled to every country in the world. Now he's giving away his frequent flyer miles on Instagram.
Look, I can always start off at zero again. That's cool for me.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. It is a sticky 84 degrees in Boston, down from the mid-90s earlier in the week. A bit unusual for August, but it's nothing like the near-record temperatures across much of the U.S., Europe, and other parts of the world. This summer, it's been spiking into the 100s in places like Spain, the U.K., Japan, and the heat seems to stick around for days, even weeks. It's part of a new emerging pattern. More on that in a few minutes. But first, let's go to Germany, where people are looking for ways to beat the heat. In Berlin, it can mean a descent into some of the city's grimmest history. Daniela Czeslow begins with that story.
Approximately 100 steps. Take your time as long as you get up there.
Tour guide Karsten Dater leads about 20 of us over an artificial hill made of rubble cleared after World War II. We're headed to a flak tower.
Flak is a German abbreviation for Flugabwehrkanone. English translation is anti-aircraft cannon or anti-aircraft gun. Flak.
In the 1940s, Hitler commissioned three flak towers in Berlin.
Flak towers are above-ground bunkers.
They were mounted with heavy guns to shoot down Allied planes and sometimes served as civilian air raid shelters.
Germany thankfully lost the Second World War. Germany and Berlin were demilitarized and bunkers were blown up.
British and Russian forces obliterated the other two flak towers, but this one in Humboldthain Park was only partially destroyed in 1948. Dater is a guide with the Berlin Underworlds Association, which restores and guides tours through the buried history of the city.
Okay, let's go in.
We walk inside and put on helmets.
Above your head is reinforced concrete, 3.8 meters, so nearly 12 feet, 11.
We're walking down a cavernous concrete staircase and looking into the shaft of it, which was destroyed after the war. But as we walk down, it is so refreshing and cold.
And that's really why I'm here. Cold places are at a premium in Berlin right now. Few buildings are air-conditioned. The daily Berliner Morgenpost has named the Flak Tower as one of the top five cold things to do in the city. Other ideas include the frigid penguin house in the city zoo and a newly opened ice bar where you can borrow a parka while you shiver. A spokesman for Berlin's environment department says he doesn't know how many buildings in the city have AC. He suggests cooling off in parks or in some of the city's many lakes. That wasn't enough for Jesse Pino. He's an American who moved to Berlin 2 years ago, and the heat has bowled him over. So he made a website.
www.kaltekarte.berlin. It's a map of air conditioning spots in Berlin.
He gets recommendations via crowdsourcing. He's found about 130 places in a city of 3.6 million people.
That's so little.
It's not enough. I'm dying here. Yeah.
Pino works at a startup in Berlin. He says his bosses have told employees to work from home on the hottest days. Half his colleagues are German, and he says they rarely complain about the lack of AC. Maybe, he says, they're onto something.
I feel like in the U.S., the approach to air conditioning is that it's very overpowering, and we want to feel like we have dominated nature and like made our mark in it, and we've made a safe space for humans. And here it feels a lot more in touch with the weather outside, which has its pluses and minuses, I guess.
Thank you very much for coming. Have a nice day here in Berlin and have a good time.
Back at the Flak Tower, I catch up with Camilla Sundberger, a tourist from Sweden. She says she's visited every site Berlin Underworlds offers over 6 days in the city, including a replica of a tunnel dug to smuggle East Berlin residents into the West during the Cold War.
My boyfriend is very interested in this. Also, since it's so hot outside, we want it to be like a bit cooler.
It's in the 90s today in Berlin. In the bunker, it stays cool. So I ask Daydirt, the guide, whether he thinks this should be a place where vulnerable people could go in the heat, like the elderly.
No. No. Why? Because it's a bunker. Because it's a bunker. And, I mean, there are even some, there, at least for the next 10, 15 years, there are even people still alive who went into bunkers in the Second World War, perhaps raising two bad memories.
But for tourists, this remnant of a dark past is an oasis. For the world, Daniela Czeslow, Berlin.
So, 95 degrees in Berlin. Record heat in Japan, Spain, Portugal, all over 100 degrees. A lot of very hot weather all around the world these past couple of months. It's pretty clear that what we're seeing now and over the past few years is not just weather as usual. I've got the world's livable planet editor, Peter Thompson, here in the studio. Can we point to climate change, Peter, as the cause of the summer's heat waves?
Well, Marco, yes and no. Even with all the change that we're causing in our climate system, with all the carbon pollution we're pumping into the atmosphere, you can't say that any one event was actually caused by climate change. On the other hand, climate change is a big factor here. At the most basic level, there's just more heat in the system, in the atmosphere, in the oceans. As we pump more of this carbon pollution into the atmosphere, it traps the heat from the sun, and that raises the baseline for all weather events all around the world. In other words, weather events are influenced by this background of warmer temperatures, so even a normal bump in summer temperatures is likely to be at least a little bit hotter than it was a few decades ago.
But here's the thing. I also understand that it's not just a simple matter of heat that's influencing our weather, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Earth's climate system is incredibly complex with all kinds of intertwined subsystems, and they all interact. And one thing that many climate scientists have been looking at very closely is the impact of all this added heat on things like the jet stream. The jet stream basically carries our weather systems, storms, heat waves, stuff like that. And in recent years, it seems to be getting both more wavy and slowing down. The waviness basically means that over the course of the year, we're seeing a lot more big masses of cold Arctic air pushing down south in the winters, a lot more warmer temperate and tropical air pushing up north to places like Western Europe. And then the slowdown of the jet stream means that weather systems are slowing down. They're sticking around longer. And all of that is likely due to the disrupting effect of more overall heat in the system.
Okay, so that is today, the summer, this year. How are things looking in the future?
Well, we're still adding huge amounts of carbon pollution to the atmosphere every day. That's going to mean a buildup of more and more heat, and that's going to mean more and more extreme weather. So that's the simplest way of looking at things. But like I said, the Earth's climate system is incredibly complex. There's actually a new report out this week that looks at kind of the breadth of that complexity, and it suggests that all that new heat in the system could be setting us up for a whole lot of knock-on effects that could fundamentally transform the planet and make it pretty much incompatible with civilization as we know it.
That's kind of scary. I mean, this report, I understand, it lays out a hothouse Earth scenario. What does that mean exactly?
Well, the paper was published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences here in the U.S. It essentially says that even if we manage to hold temperatures to that 2 degrees Celsius target in the Paris Climate Accord, even that supposedly safe threshold may well pull some triggers that will pick up momentum over time and eventually build a runaway warming that could take us into a much warmer planet.
And briefly, what are some of those processes?
Well, there's things like the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet, changes in the ocean circulations like the El Niño process in the Pacific, changes to the Amazon rainforest, even thawing permafrost. There's twice as much carbon in permafrost in the Northern Hemisphere than there is already in the atmosphere. If that starts to get out, that could be a runaway scenario.
So I start to see the complexity of these patterns and these systems. Are these systems linked in any way?
They're not linked in any kind of lockstep way, but they each interact with the other ones. These scientists have laid out a scenario under which a certain level of warming will cause some runaway changes in one system, and that will make changes in another system more likely. So they all affect each of the other ones.
Yeah, you call these runaway systems. What can actually be done to prevent this hothouse Earth scenario, or is there anything?
Well, the most basic thing that can be done is to take very rapid and extreme measures to cut our carbon emissions. Not just cut them, but actually suck carbon out of the atmosphere. There are technologies that are being developed. Sucking carbon out of the atmosphere is becoming more viable, although it's still at a very small scale. blocking sunlight actually is a fairly simple prospect, but it has all kinds of other perhaps knock-on effects. You know, everything you do affects everything else in the system. That's one thing we're learning in a big way. So nothing is clean.
Peter, are we about to face a point of no return, or are we there already?
This study does not go into whether we're there already, and I'm not sure anybody can say that. I think that the study points to things that we can do to try to limit our risk. But very quickly, we have to move extremely quickly, much more quickly than we're moving now, to try to provide some kind of buffer against the more extreme changes and tamp down the possibility of reaching that 2-degree threshold.
The World's Livable Planet editor, Peter Thompson, thanks for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Okay, back to dealing with the heat. Allow me to get a little inside Boston here. Brigham's or Gelato Fiasco? If you ask Bostonians which of those two local ice cream brands they prefer, the answer may reveal a little something about class. Richard Feinberg is a Cuba scholar, and he's discovered ice cream consumption in Havana these days also tips to class differences. He says gone are the days when Havana's Copelia, once known as the socialist cathedral of ice cream, had the best scoop in town.
Whereas they used to offer a dozen or more flavors, now on any given day they might just have 3 or 4 flavors. And the ingredients, Cubans will tell you, are not what they used to be. Powdered milk, for example, is now a luxury in Cuba. And the workers at Copelia sometimes siphon some of that off.
Is there a black market for ice cream in Cuba?
Certainly, particularly from the state-owned firms. Ice cream will disappear from the factories or fall off the back of the truck. Both the ice cream itself as well as the ingredients. State workers sometimes will work at the state ice cream establishments, not for the salaries, which are so low, but so they can siphon off some of the ingredients, such as powdered milk, and sell those then on the black market.
And now with Cuba's economy loosening up just a little bit and fits and starts, things are getting a little more diverse in the ice cream range, but it's not as though Ben and Jerry's is within easy reach. What do you find, though, in like Havana these days?
Nestle's produces and sells ice cream. Nestle is, of course, being a non-U.S. investor, so they have been allowed to invest. It's not great. It's standardized. It's industrial tasting, but it is safe and predictable and does carry with it a certain social status. So that's for the emerging middle classes, let's say the top 20% of the Cuban population. But for the 1%, they now have yet a more grandiose option. There are now private temples of ice cream pleasure, former mansions that have been converted into Italian-style ice cream parlors where it's air-conditioned, short, if any, lines, and lots of artisan flavors, mango, lime, coconut. They offer a mojito flavor with fresh Cuban rum. These last types of ice cream parlors, Italian style, are offered by private entrepreneurs in Cuba. And so that's a new offering to your Cuban consumer, but it's way more expensive than your average Cuban could even dream of affording. So it's just for that top 1%.
So, Richard, you were talking a moment ago about Cuba's government allowing private food establishments to operate, but I gather last summer they suspended new licenses for private food establishments. So what's up now?
Well, the Cuban bureaucracy is still very much run in a monopolistic way by the Cuban Communist Party, sort of freaked out at the success of the emerging private sector, particularly restaurants, which were attracting much of the tourist crowd as well as the better-heeled Cubans. So they froze the issuing of new licenses and recently have put out a new set of regulations governing private sector firms, which we'll see how they implement them, but they look pretty tough. So it's going to be more and more difficult for restaurants or private ice cream parlors to operate in Cuba. But they're not going to eliminate them, though, we hope, and we'll see how the new regulations are implemented.
That's Cuba scholar and ice cream lover Richard Feinberg in San Diego. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. yet another regulatory bump in the road for Uber and other ride-hailing services. I'm talking about the set of bills New York City approved yesterday, temporarily putting a halt on new licenses for the services. Over the next year, the city will study how these companies affect traffic congestion and how much they should be paying their drivers. Of course, New York's not the only city that's gone after Uber and other for-hire car services recently.
Uber has been facing a lot of regulatory pressure from governments in places like Spain, in the Middle East. And we also recently saw the company go to blows with the Transport Authority in London.
Johanna Buya covers transportation for Recode.
It's a very interesting time, you know, even in places where the company has been free to operate under the current regulatory regime, they're still being forced to come up against new regulatory questions. And so in Spain, the government passed bills that are similar to the bills in New York City, where the Uber's vehicle licenses have been capped.
And generally speaking, Johanna, is it basically pressure between the sharing economy that Uber operates in and established taxi companies?
Oftentimes it is. So we saw that in Spain. The reason why the government in Spain decided to pass these bills was that there was this, you know, multi-day taxi driver strike. In Brazil, there was a sort of similar situation. And Uber, as well as its competitors, were recently able to, after, you know, months of lobbying, get favorable regulations there. But oftentimes it is out of the government trying to ensure that established industries are not being completely undercut by these new technologies.
Does Uber dominate the ride-sharing industry globally?
Not exactly. That was the case maybe 2 years ago. Their international strategy is pretty interesting. Before, it used to be in the Uber 1.0 days, it was boots on the ground everywhere. You need to be everywhere. Uber needs to be the transport platform of choice for everyone in the world. That clearly was not financially sustainable. So they've pulled out of Russia. They've pulled out of China. You know, we saw in Southeast Asia, Uber had to pull out. The deal that the company came to with the homegrown player Grab was more favorable than deals that Uber had with China's homegrown player Didi. Still, it was out of necessity. The company was definitely not doing as well as it expected to across Southeast Asia, and that's why they've had to pull out. In India, Uber's market share might be a little bit more comparable to its competitor there, Ola. However, it is a very difficult market to compete in.
So you just rattled off several companies, only one I've heard of, Grab, Didi, Ola. What are those local companies doing that's giving them a competitive edge?
So that's sort of the thesis that they had from the beginning. They believe that the whole ride-hail game was only going to be won by companies that were homegrown, understood the local nuances of each of their markets.
Yeah, I heard about the Ola app in India. You're actually allowed to pay cash. You don't have to kind of pay through a credit card.
Yep, exactly. And so they have their own digital wallet that you could pay. You basically fill it up with cash. And you can just go to a local retail store that partners with the company and fill up your card or your wallet with cash right on location. And that's sort of, it sounds kind of backwards for the U.S., but in a lot of places, people are unbanked. They don't have credit cards. So being able to access this sort of digital on-demand transportation system was basically impossible without this cash payment.
Right. So local companies responding to local needs. Do the homegrown companies in other countries face the same regulatory pressures Uber is facing in those countries, or are local governments cutting them more slack?
Not that I know of. So basically, a lot of it, the dichotomy often is ride-hail versus taxi, more so than it is Uber versus their ride-hail competitor. That said, you know, there could be things that are happening behind the scenes, particularly in places where nationalism is very strong.
I noticed that in Paris during the final for the World Cup, bike delivery workers for Uber Eats went on strike in protest over their working conditions. And they did it when the French soccer fans wanted pizza during the final. So even among some Uber employees, if we can call them that, it's not all rosy.
No, and that's kind of been the case, you know, since Uber has existed. Drivers felt like they were, you know, in the beginning, they were promised one thing. They were promised a certain salary. And as Uber grew and as Uber, you know, had to sort of try to attract new drivers or new riders, they've cut their rates. And it's been a push and pull with Uber's contractors for years. You know, Uber is sort of facing pressure on a number of fronts. They're facing pressure from taxi drivers who are upset that Uber has kind of taken their lunch. And then they're also facing pressure from their own contractors who feel like they're not being paid well.
Johanna Buya, Recode's senior transportation reporter, speaking with us from New York. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Do you ever wonder how many frequent flyer miles you'd earn traveling around the whole world? James Asquith wants you to guess. He's the Guinness World Record holder for the youngest person to travel to all 196 sovereign countries. He was 24. Now he's 29, and he's giving away all of his air miles on Instagram to the person who can guess how many he has. Here's a hint. It's enough to fly around the world 3 times. We caught up with James in Indonesia and asked him what got him started on his travels.
I remember getting my very first backpack, and the guy in the store said, "Hey, get this one because it's really durable. You know, you're gonna get the travel bug." And I was thinking, absolutely not. You know, I'm just going on this trip. I went to Southeast Asia actually, went and volunteered building some houses with my two best friends in Vietnam, and I kind of went out there and I did absolutely pick up the travel bug, the freedom, kind of how it made me feel. I went out there as an 18-year-old. I was incredibly naive. You know, I didn't really have respect for cultures. I didn't understand much about myself, and I grew and learned a lot. And I've still got that backpack now. I just picked it up as I went along. But even then, I never thought I was going to go and see every country in the world. I guess I just got carried away with that bit.
So, James, you've got all these frequent flyer miles. Why give them away to the person who can guess how many you've got? Don't you want to keep traveling?
Absolutely. But I thought, you know what, I build up a bunch of air miles, and I actually don't necessarily use them that much. And I thought, hey, I get asked all the time by people, how is the best way to use air miles? People always saying, how can you sometimes travel in business class, or how can you travel so much? And it always gets asked, and I love seeing how it inspires people, because travel is the biggest thing that's ever inspired me. It was the best education I had, learning about different cultures, how people think differently and how people think the same, learn about food, religion, like, and it really kind of, I feel like, made me a more interesting person and made me a better person. So look, you know, I'll start off at zero again. That's cool for me.
And you are at James Asquith on Instagram?
James Asquith Travel, yes. And it's not confirmed yet. And I can't give too many details, but it looks like we might hopefully be doing something quite exciting with the air miles thing to try and extend it to a few more people, because there's been some fantastic stories that have come in as to, you know, people that haven't seen relatives for years, and, you know, long distance relationships where they haven't seen each other for like 3 years, and just some incredible stories. We're very hopeful that hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we might be able to do something to really inspire a few more people around the world.
James Asquith is the founder of the holiday home exchange Holiday Swap. He's also the Guinness World Record holder for the youngest person to travel 196 countries. He's been speaking with us from Indonesia. James, thanks very much.
Thanks very much for having me. Really appreciate your time.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. Most Americans don't have a will. 20 years ago, that wasn't a shocking statement. You had to find a trustworthy attorney and pay them by the hour to draft your will. But these days, there's no excuse. LegalZoom has made it easy to create your own will, and they're not a law firm, so you don't pay hourly rates. August is National Make a Will Month at LegalZoom.com. So now it's your turn to take control of your family and assets with an estate plan. It starts with a will or a living trust. And if you don't know which one is right for you, no problem. LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys can advise you on what's best for you and your family. That's why more than 1 million people have used LegalZoom for their estate planning needs. Just go to LegalZoom.com/world to check out LegalZoom's Last Will and Living Trust Estate Plans and get special savings. That's LegalZoom.com/world to take care of your family and save money doing it. LegalZoom.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World:
Double, 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 toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
This is Shakespeare translated into Basque. By all rights, the Basque language should be dead, but somehow it survived in Spain and France and among immigrants to America. That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. All this week on the show, we're hearing about how the languages we speak are changing. Nina Porzucchi from our podcast, The World in Words, is back with us. Good to see you, Nina.
Hey, Marco. So today I'm going to tell you about a language that's kind of mysterious, and mysterious because we don't really know where it came from. It doesn't have any linguistic relatives, and it's also mysterious because it is still spoken quite widely around Europe. So, Marco, do you know any words in Basque?
Basque. Okay, so this little part of Spain. A tricky T-shirt.
That's my
mnemonic device for the word triquitisha, which is, as everybody knows, the diatonic accordion played by such virtuoso Basque players as Kepa Junkera.
Yeah, there. Everybody knows that. Triquitisha.
It's still spoken in Spain, northern Spain and southwest France, right?
That's right. And it's actually doing pretty well in Spain, and far better in Spain than it is in France. But the story that I'm going to tell you actually begins in the middle of World War II, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So a man named Bingen Amatzaga was on a ship. He was en route to South America. He was fleeing Spain and the dictatorship of General Francisco Franco. And this ship, it's just packed with other exiles from Spain and from everywhere else. They're just past Cuba when the ship suddenly was stopped.
They were stopped in the middle of the ocean by a German U-boat.
Stopped in the middle of the ocean by a German U-boat.
Yes. And that guy that you just heard, that is Bingen Amatzaga's grandson, Xavier Orujo. So everyone knew that there were threats of these German subs, U-boats. And they had been sinking ships in the Atlantic all through the war. So you didn't want to mess with them at all. And Xavier's grandfather and everyone else on board were ordered by the captain to put on their life jackets and go to the main deck, which was now full of German submariners.
And they started to take from the people things, you know, like gold, but also food, a lot of food.
Gold and food, probably equally as valuable at this point. But none of it was as valuable to Bingen as a manuscript he had concealed below deck. It was something that had kept him busy during his long days at sea, part of an effort to save the Basque language. So, of course, if the Germans killed Bingen and the other people on board the ship, the manuscript itself wouldn't survive.
And there goes the language.
And there goes an effort to save the language. But miraculously, the Germans let the exiles go. They just took their food.
Probably they ran off food. So they needed some, and they took it from the boat. And that's why they didn't sink it.
Wow. So because some Germans were hungry, Bingen Amatzaga's life was saved. And what was that manuscript exactly that he was working on?
It was the very first translation of Shakespeare's great play, Macbeth, into Basque.
Do you want me to read it in English and then you can read it in, Basque?
Yeah.
So I'll start with all together. Double, 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 toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
Nekeak eta kezkak borretzen ekin. Suak errebeza bertzak irakin.
Fillet of a fenny snake, in the cauldron boil and bake. Eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog.
And I should tell you, Marco, that Bingen's grandson here, who's reading the Basque, Xavier Rujo, he's actually the director for Basque studies at UNR, the University of Nevada, Reno.
I want to hear more of Macbeth and Basque. Anyway, that is an amazing story, but Nina, I'm assuming it means more than just this manuscript getting found on this boat.
Right. So Bingen Amatzaga, the translator of Shakespeare, he was part of an early movement to standardize the Basque language. Bingen and a group of fellow Basque intellectuals and nationalists, they believed that the only way to strengthen the Basque culture and the nation and to save the language from extinction was to unite the many, many dialects of Basque into one standard version of the language. And translation was part of that effort.
By translating, you get a political goal and also a linguistic goal. If you translate Hamlet, for example, from English into Basque, you have to choose the dialect in which you are going to be translating into. According to them, the best dialect was the Gipuzkoan dialect.
So the Gipuzkoan dialect, that's what he said. That's the dialect spoken in the very heart of the Basque Country. And that's the one that was chosen by this group of elders, some of who didn't even actually speak that dialect, but they recognized that they needed to agree on one.
Okay, so they're translating things into this one dialect that these elders agreed upon. Did it catch on with the people at large?
Oh, well, so in Spain, under Franco's military dictatorship, speaking Basque, teaching Basque, publishing in Basque, basically doing anything in Basque was technically illegal. And that continued until Franco's death in 1975.
Yeah, so you can see how the pushback against that illegality gave rise to extremism, to ETA, the Basque nationalist terrorist group, all sorts of things.
Yeah, I want to just caution that ETA was not supported by most Basques.
Right.
But partly because of this ban on the language, many Basque leaders and intellectuals, like Binyan Amanzaga, they went abroad into a kind of self-imposed exile.
When they went to exile for the first time, they thought it was going to be a short exile, that Franco was going to be beaten by, you know, the Allies in the course of World War II, that it was going to last only 5 years, then 10, then 15.
And then 30 plus. So Basque leaders were organizing from exile. So you imagine this is kind of pre-internet times we're talking about here. Basque centers were formed around the world. So were Basque schools. And Binyan Amanzaga on that ship sort of launched, not knowing where they would land, and they actually wound up in Uruguay, and then they went on to Venezuela, where he continued to keep translating works of Shakespeare. All of these intellectuals all over the world, imagine trying to standardize your language under those circumstances.
And when the language itself is banned back home.
Exactly. So in public, in Basque Country, more and more Basques were speaking Spanish because they had to. But Basques are nothing if not determined, some might say stubborn. And under Franco, they continued this debate among themselves over how best to ensure that the language survived. And they continued this debate oftentimes in secret. And in the 1960s, people came up with a new idea, Batua.
Batua was a proposal for a new code of standard Basque, unified Basque, as the word Batua means, unified.
So, Nina, this was a different dialect from the other one we heard about, the Gipuzkoan?
Gipuzkoa? Yeah. So this Batua is not one dialect. It's kind of a mishmash of a bunch of different dialects. That, who you just heard, by the way, is Alan King, and he is an honorary member of the Basque Language Academy. He's lived in Basque Country for the past 40 years. And he told me a little bit about Batua. Batua is different. Instead of choosing one dialect over the others, it took bits and pieces from all of the different dialects, hence its name, Unified Basque.
So you described it kind of as a mishmash of dialects. How did Batua become the standard?
It wasn't easy. Right. There was a lot of debate. And there was one point of contention that sort of came to symbolize the sort of pros and cons against Batua. And it all centered around the letter H.
H.
People basically went sort of crazy about the H being pro-H or anti-H.
In most of Basque Country, the H became silent centuries ago. Kind of like in Spanish, the H is not pronounced. It's dropped from written Basque. But in the north, in that small pocket of France where Basque is spoken, they still enunciate their H's. And the proponents of Batua, they said, let's use the letter H because just because we don't pronounce it doesn't mean that we shouldn't include it because there are like a dialects in the north that do use and pronounce the letter H. So let's just include it and it'll be silent like in Spanish.
The reason was for inclusion so that the Northern Basques weren't left out. In this way, trying to achieve the unity or the reunification of the whole country.
Well, that fight got political. It got vicious. There were diatribes against H. And
it finally came to a head at this famous meeting in Arantzazu.
A monastery in the Basque Country, Arantzazu. And in 1968, all of the greatest Basque thinkers, linguists, met at this monastery.
There was a motion on the table to adopt Batua as the official way of writing Basque from there on. There were a lot of people who very angrily spoke against it, and it actually looked as though the motion was not going to be adopted.
And then a linguist by the name of Pierre Lafitte, he stood up,
not a very imposing man, you know, physically imposing, a humble, frail man.
And he gave a speech on behalf of the Northern Basques. He said,
"Seeing that things have come to a head, I believe that the correct way forward is to stop writing H."
So the guy from the pro-H writing part of Basque Country says, we're going to give up the H?
Yeah, exactly. And he went on to explain that, you know,
our Northern Basque may perhaps die out, but you must keep it alive. If you don't see fit to spell with the H, then we should not stand in the way.
Wow, the great unifier all over the letter H. What happened then?
He sat down, and apparently that was when they decided to say yes to the H.
So they said yes to the H, perhaps because he was so, you know, humble about saying you can drop it. He cared more about the language itself than, you know, whether we have an H or we don't have an H. You know, that was kind of beside the point.
I don't know if he was gaslighting them or there's some great Solomonic lesson here. Anyway, I got to try that approach sometime. So Batua is what's used today and with an H.
Yes, an updated version of it. And there's one more Basque speaker that I wanted to introduce you to. Begochu Olaisola. And she teaches at an Ikastola in a small town.
Ikastola, I saw you just slip that in there as if you're now fluent in Basque. I'm assuming
I'm so
that
good
means
at Basque.
Like, that's Basque for school.
Yeah, it's actually a neologism that means factory of knowledge. Ikastolas were started in the 1920s and the early 30s as a response to kind of growing factions that didn't want people to speak Basque.
There were schools that used Basque as a medium of instruction. Then they were forbidden during the Franco's dictatorship.
So during that time, during Franco's dictatorship, many parents chose just straight out not to pass on Basque to their children. It was seen as kind of something that was going to hurt their children.
This is what, for example, happened to my father.
Her grandparents, her father's parents, were told by Jesuit priests that ran her father's school to just stop speaking Basque with him at home. And they did.
He understands Basque. He tries to speak some, and I can speak to him in Basque, but if the conversation gets very, very complicated, or because we're into politics or something more complicated than that, he always tells me, you can continue in Basque. I won't answer in Basque, but I understand you. This happens in many families.
So in the 70s, following Franco's death, the Ikastolas gradually became legal. And today there are about 300 of them throughout Basque Country, teaching in Basque, like all of your lessons, math, you know, science, the whole thing. And the schools have been critical in spreading the language to younger generations, but they're also making Basque a social reality. And that is something that's different than just learning a language. Like, for example, Bikochu's son, he's 15. He's been going to school in Basque his entire life, and they speak Basque at home, but he also can go to a store and speak Basque or speak Basque on the street with his friends. And he watches Basque language TV and his life is lived in Basque, which is different than just learning a language.
But I'm not sure if it's going to be enough.
You don't think it's going to be enough with all the Ikastolas and the rise of dual language immersion schools? And
I don't know if even languages like French and Spanish worry. Imagine a situation for languages like Basque or Welsh or Catalan.
So you can almost hear the wariness in her voice there.
Yeah. What are the numbers? Like, how many people speak Basque today?
There's somewhere between 600 and 900,000. So inside Spanish Basque Country, that's about 37% of the people there.
Mm.
In France, where the language isn't officially recognized, it's much, much less.
What happened to the guy who translated Macbeth into Basque? Did he ever return to Basque Country?
Oh, being in Amatzaga?
Yeah.
Well, he sadly, no. He was still living in exile when he heard the news that Unified Basque in 1968 had been chosen as the standard. And so right away, being the translator and being the, you know, champion of a unified language, he took out his old translations, his old, you know, Macbeth, and he set to work retranslating the Shakespeare into this new unified Basque. But sadly, he passed away 3 months later, and he never ever returned to the Basque Country. But the silver lining, his grandson was able to publish Macbeth in Basque, and you can actually buy his translation. Quite cool.
Nina Porzuki of our podcast, The World in Words. This was fascinating. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
And that Basque musician I mentioned at the start of my conversation with Nina, here he is, Kepa Junquera, playing the diatonic accordion on his album Bilbao Zero Hour. We find music in so many different ways these days, at the gym, in a club, on the radio perhaps, or a streaming service suggestion. Maybe a friend plays you a song and you like what you hear. That's what happened to our Across Women's Lives correspondent, Alison Herrera, in Ukraine. And Alison joins me now. And I'm always psyched, Alison, when my friends and colleagues discover on their own music that I'm a fan of. And this is a terrific band I've seen a couple of times, Daka Braka from Kiev, Ukraine. How did you discover them?
Okay, Marco, let me set the scene for you here. So recently I was in Ukraine for a reporting trip. I'm driving down a two-lane road marked with numerous potholes, passing by field after field of flowers, giant stork nests, and I'm heading towards Chernobyl. So the team I'm traveling with in the car, including Across Women's Live producer Andrea Crossan, we're all taking turns playing DJ. She played Kendrick Lamar. I played Kurt Vile and the Violators. I woke up this morning, didn't recognize the man in the mirror. Then I left and I said, and then Anastasia Vaslova, our photographer, was just sitting in the front seat and she said, "Hey, check out this music." And so she played us this song from Daka Braka called Karpetsky Rap or Carpathian Rap. Послухайте, люди, добре, що хочу казати. Я хочу про всіх хлопців співанку співати. Якби знала моя мамка, що то може Дмитро. Let me just say, first of all, that your playlist of Kendrick Lamar, Kurt Vile, and Daka Braka, I mean, that's an amazing playlist. This song, Carpathian Rap, it is a Daka Braka classic. So what do they actually rap about? Marco, it's about sex. This song is about a woman who is talking about her sexual partners to her babushka, her grandmother.
Wow.
She's basically trying to find a husband. I mean, it's an old song with a 2018 theme here. She's basically saying that, you know, she's tried on all these men for size and none of them really suits her. The person to better explain the song is one of the members of Daka Braka, Olena Tibulska. She sings and plays percussion, and the band was playing in a club here in Minneapolis last week when I asked her about the song. Olena told me that it's about a girl who wanted to find a husband and goes through one after another because there were always these issues that arose. This one had a bad mother. This one doesn't own a house. This one's nose is crooked, for example. So there were always some shortcomings that did not satisfy her. And I'll say, too, you know, Nina Kharanetska, who plays the cello and sings in the group, she told me that she recorded this song from a grandma in a village. So it's an old song passed down from generation to generation. And like I said, even though it's an old song, it's so 2018. I mean, who doesn't want to hear a song where women talk about their sex partners?
Yeah, and so, talking to their grandmothers about their sex partners.
Exactly,
too.
Exactly.
So I'm really glad you got to see them in Minneapolis. Your photographer in Ukraine, Anastasia, why is this one of her favorite bands?
Well, she really likes that song, and she really likes how the group incorporates this kind of old Ukrainian folk tradition with new sounds. And I spoke to her via Skype, so the connection's not so great. And here's what she said about Karpetsky Rap.
you hear the Ukrainian motifs, but it's like really a rap song. And it's kind of cool that they do this twist with the traditional motifs and what is quite catchy now. But still, it doesn't sound cheap or vulgar.
This is really cool, I got to say, Allison, because your discovery is also my discovery. I've spoken with the band about the politics in their music, but I gather you've picked up on another major theme in their songs about what it's like to be a woman in Ukraine. Is that right?
That's true. And you're right. Their songs are about politics. They see feminism in America as totally something different from Ukrainian feminism. You know, life for women in Ukraine are changing, as we've been reporting on. There's still a long way to go for women in that country, as far as jobs and getting paid as much as men. Just, you know, obviously some of the same issues that we have here in the United States. And I think another thing that's really distinctive and makes their songs really, you know, storytelling about women is the way that they sing those songs. They're bringing back this Ukrainian culture. They're bringing back Ukrainian tradition, because I think for a lot of years, people still view them as part of the Soviet Union. So they're also bringing back something uniquely Ukrainian, and from their dress, which is pretty amazing. I'm sure you've seen those tall lamb's wool hats.
Incredible.
To the type of music that they sing.
So, Allison, as you know, we love referring people to good under-the-radar music on the world, but where can we actually see Daka Braka now? You saw them in Minneapolis. Are they doing any other American dates anytime soon?
Get your dance card ready, because their next stop is in Madison, Wisconsin, on August 15th, and I might actually even make the drive to go over and see them, because I had such a good time.
Yeah, I know you'll have another good time, too, if you go. I'd like to say I'll make the drive, but for better or worse, I've got other plans. Anyway, if you're in the neighborhood, definitely catch Daka Braka. Our Across Women's Lives correspondent, Allison Herrera, thanks so much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Here's more Daka Braka and their song, Sho Zupo Duba. If you want to see photos of Allison's wild night out with Daka Braka, it's on the Across Women's Lives Instagram. Look for that at Women's Lives. I'm Marco Werman, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Sit back and enjoy Daka Braka. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.